I'm Stephen M. Hall, MD, an integral physician.
And I'm Grace Porter, a licensed psychotherapist. And together, we're the 7 Tools, a company focused on your personal growth and transformation.
And you are here with us for the Change for Good Summit. This year, we're focusing on building resilience in anxious times.
This summit is full of deep conversation and practical advice. We hope you enjoy this interview.
So now let's dive in. Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Hall with the 2019 Change for Good Summit, Building Resilience in Anxious Times. So I'm really excited for you to hear our next speaker. Her name is Julie James, and she's the director and principal instructor for the Green Wisdom School of Herbal Studies in Southern California. She provides training in traditional Western herbalism and related modalities with over 30 years of training and practice in herbalism and nutrition. So we've both been in practice about the same amount of time, it sounds like. So she also teaches at conferences and festivals all over the country, and particularly delights in introducing people to hands-on growing of herbs and medicine making, strengthening the connection between plants and people, and in doing so, weaving the web of interdependency between all beings. Sounds really cool. So Julie, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you came to be an herbalist?
Sure. So I am a child of Southern. I've never lived anywhere but California. I'm the youngest of a very large family, and my older sister used to take me out into the foothills and the mountains around our house where we grew up, and she. It astonished me. I can still remember the feeling of amazement that she knew the names of the plants. She was able to take me to fennel and tell me the name of it and encourage me to nibble on the seeds. And it was amazing to think that you could know that it wasn't just all green, it wasn't just all weeds, it wasn't just trees, but they all had names, specific identities. And she was really the one who, you know, and this was in the 70s. And so she was using some of the old school herbs as golden seal and things like that that were around. I was lucky enough in Santa Barbara, which is where I grew up. We also had a medicinal herb clinic, the Trees Medical Clinic. And so I was working at one of our health food stores there, and across the street was the Trees Medical Clinic, and I used to go there and just hang out and ask the man who ran it questions and just pestered him, and eventually he let me fill bottles with herbs and just let me play, and he eventually, you know, let me just kind of intern there and be there. Later on, I traveled up to Northern California with my partner at that time, and got to take some training at the California School of Herbal Studies, which is up in the Sebastopol area. And up until that time, I had been studying biochemistry with the trajectory towards learning nutrition, because I love chemistry. I love physiology, I love all of that, and just seemed like biochemistry would be the way to go. So I was studying chemistry in college and excited about that. But then when I went to herb school and I got really the training and the understanding and the connection with the plants that let me realize how much better chemists they were than us, and how much more complex plant chemistry was than isolated constituents, that was kind of mind-blowing. And so I came back and thought, you know, I don't want to. I love chemistry. I still love chemistry. I will always love chemistry because it's fun, because it's part of magic for me. But that was when I realized what I want to do is be an herbalist. And so I came back and became an herbalist.
Oh, great.
And, you know, it was one of those things where all of the steps were kind of laid in front of me. And it was a really easy and comfortable move words. Sometimes it's not that easy to find your path in life. But for me, it was just really just a set of steps moving forward.
Oh, that's really cool. So as you know, a lot of herbal traditions, they focus not just on the chemical makeup of the herb, but they also talk about, say, an energetic quality or maybe even magical or mystical quality. So how was it, coming from a science background, how was it for you to embrace that aspect of herbs as well?
Yeah. So one of my favorite things I teach, one of my very good friends is a witch. He's a brilliant, brilliant witch. And he and I co-teach together. And one of the most fun things for both of us is that we will co-teach a class on, we call it where two paths meet. And we will talk about plants that are used in both of our traditions in clinical herbalism and in magic. And the fun thing, Steve, is that I'll talk about the chemistry, or he'll talk about traditional usage, and we can see that a plant like yarrow, which is used magically for protection, for psychic action, and quite often is like grown in areas where you feel vulnerable, you feel like you need that protection. Well, yarrow is one of those plants that gives you that shield. And when we look at traditional usage of the plant medicinally, and when we look at the chemistry of the plant, we see physiological effects and chemistry that reinforce appropriate boundaries in our cells and boundaries in our tissues, and boundaries to our immune system and boundaries to the vascular walls. And, you know, it's just over and over and over we would find that, and it's awesome.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. I love it so much.
Yeah. So how do you define anxiety? And what do you see like stress and anxiety doing to people's bodies?
I find with anxiety on a larger scale, one of the most valuable ways of conceptualizing anxiety and all of the things that spring from that is a lack of feeling of safety, right? We mm-hmm. don't feel safe in our bodies, in our culture, in our world, in our situation. It is that lack of feeling safe. And that, I think, is so critical. And it's something that, you know, is fed by so many things. That loss of safety affects our stress response, of course, but it also is part of our immune response. If we are not safe, then we have an immune response that becomes vigilant and hyper-responsive and hyperactive and looks for what is there in our environment that we are not feeling safe about. When we have all of the physiological responses to that lack of safety, that anxiety, heart palpitations, increased trauma, it helps us to understand why so often anxiety, we can feel this overwhelm of anxiety and think, what is there to feel anxious about? I don't see, there's nothing that has caused a trigger. But really, when we look deeper, there are so many things that can trigger that lack of safety. And that's where things like food sensitivities. If we have a sensitivity to a food and we eat that food, and our gastrointestinal tract, you know, the majority of our immune cells line our digestive tract, are in our gut. Mm-hmm. And you know, that feel, that language that we have used of knowing things in our gut and feeling things in our gut,
yeah.
that feeling of anxiety that hits us in the pit of the stomach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the gut is our enteric brain. That is where we have more neurotransmitters. We have more of our brain function in our gut, or as much as in our brain itself. And so when we eat something, for example, that we may not even have a full-blown allergy to, but our body doesn't like it, so we could throw, say, wheat in there, right? So we eat some wheat, and It hits our gut. We haven't completely digested it. Why haven't we completely digested it? Well, part of the reason is because anxiety shuts down our digestive system. Because when we are under stress, one of the last things that our body wants to waste energy on is to digest our food. Right. So we shut down the digestive system. We're unable to digest our food. The food is moving through the gut into the intestinal tract, where the immune system gets completely overwhelmed and freaked out because our undigested proteins in there, and undigested proteins in our gut is what our physiology sees as pathogens invading our gut. So we can have a full-blown inflammatory response in the body, immune response in the body, and that inflammatory response causes triggers of our neurological system, our immune system, our vascular system. Everything responds to that inflammatory reaction to wheat.
Yeah.
And all of the other things that are making us feel unsafe. So I think that concept is really helpful for us to kind of widen the scope of what we tend to think are triggers for our anxiety. It also gives us a lot of ways that we can treat it, right? That gives us a lot of concerns, but it's also a lot of pathways towards healing.
So those of us who have been in practice for a few decades, people I've been talking to, we seem to be seeing a higher incidence of anxiety than we did 20, 30 years ago, and especially in young people. And I'm curious, have you seen the same kind of thing? And if so, what do you think's causing that? I mean, we grew up, we had mutually assured destruction hanging over our heads the whole time, and we weren't anxious that much. So what do you think's going on?
We had mutually assured destruction, but it wasn't constantly in our face, especially as youngsters, right? It was easy for us to ignore that as children, harder for adults. But for a 13-year-old, for example, I have a 13-year-old son, and he's struggling with anxiety right now. So this is a question that hits close to home for me.
Yeah. But,
you know, it's the culture that we live in right now. It is harder to separate yourself from what's happening in the world because there's so much information coming towards us at all times in so many areas. It's even for children, it's really hard to shut off that sensory overload coming at us, especially when we have, you know, computers and phones and the internet and, you know, all of the technology that constantly keeps us connected to that and constantly creates this need to always have the information coming and all of that. So I think that's definitely one of the things. Also, it is not a safe world in our food supply. Our food supply is significantly different now than it was when you and I were 13. There are so many things in our food supply that when we take it into our body, will trigger that lack of feeling of safety. It's hard for the body to feel safe when the liver is overwhelmed with these trans fats that it does not know how to metabolize, because those are not compounds that are found naturally in the world. You do not see these hydrogenated fats that are our livers.
The 80,000 different organic residues of pesticides and things too.
Yeah. The antibiotics that are fed to feedlot animals, the plastics and pesticides and preservatives, and, you know, it's just a different world.
And the loss, probably there's a lot of degradation in the soil too, as far as minerals and just the basic things that the plants need to be healthy. That's probably changed a lot even in our lifetime.
There was an analysis done of the USDA dietary evaluations of foods from the early 2000s, comparing it to 100 years ago. And the change in the nutrient status of foods in the last 100 years, and this is from the USDA's information, This is their the difference in the information that they've collected on the same crops, the same foods. The difference, because exactly as you've said, we've been growing the same crops over and over and over on the same soil. We throw NPK, we throw potassium and phosphorus and nitrogen into the soil and think that that will grow our foods. Well, it does, but those are three of over 60 different required minerals and elements that we need. The plants don't need them, but we sure do. Yeah, definitely. I think you've hit spot on. You've hit, you know, you're eating good, healthy food. If we're eating a good diet, we're still not getting the same amount of nutrition we did 100 years ago.
And that's bound to affect brain function and resiliency and all that sort of thing. Is that your estimation as well?
Absolutely, it is.
Just like there's lots of different classifications for drugs, you know, like antibiotics and blood pressure meds and diabetes meds, antidepressants, things like that. There's also many classifications for herbs. And so can you talk a little bit about those classifications?
Sure. Yeah. So there are different ways to classify herbs. We can classify them by, well, as you were talking about the, earlier, we can talk about the energetics of herbs, right? So some herbs are warming, they increase our vital response and they stimulate circulation. They are things like cayenne and ginger and cinnamon. Everyone understands warming herbs. And there are cooling herbs. So there are herbs like the sour herbs, lemon balm and verbena. Bitter herbs are cooling. There are herbs that change our fluid balance, that bring moisture into the body. They're moistening or they are drying. They move fluids out of the body. So that's one way of classifying herbs, is their energetic response, which is totally chemistry, by the way. And then also by actions. And herbal actions, sometimes there is a, we use the same terminology for medical compounds, for medicines, as we use herbs. But there are certain terms which are very specifically used for herbs, and certain terms that we very specifically do not use for medicines. So some of my favorite, one of my favorite classifications of herbs to use are nutritives, specifically because of what you are talking about. Because our foods do not contain the same amount of nutrients, we need more nutrition. And sure, we can take supplements, and I am a proponent of supplements. I strongly approve of supplements, but it is irrefutable that our body recognizes and will absorb things from a whole food source, whether that food is plants or other types of foods, more than it will recognize it from an isolated, concentrated supplement, right? So, right. So nutritive herbs are herbs like nettle and oat straw and horsetail and red clover and alfalfa. These are plants that tend to accumulate. They are bioaccumulators of minerals and other compounds, flavonoids. Minerals and flavonoids are generally the large classifications of compounds that we see in these. These are plants that accumulate and hold these nutrients in their foliage, in their roots. And so when we use those as teas, we're getting all of those minerals that are not found in the foods that at large corporate agribusinesses are growing. Our kale does not have all of those nutrients in it, but we can drink some nettle tea and we can get those that complex nourishment coming in there. So, in fact, I think that is one of the best ways of the best reasons for using herbs, is to get that profound nourishment that we are no longer getting from our food supply.
That's really interesting. I appreciate that.
Another classification of herbs for the purposes of our discussion that I think is extremely important are the nervines. So nervine herbs are herbs that have an effect on the nervous system. Now, it doesn't tell us a whole lot to have an effect on the nervous system, because we can have a stimulating effect on the nervous system, right? Caffeine is nervine. It's not terribly helpful for us, but it does have an effect. So we can have stimulant nervines, and we can have calming or relaxing nervines. And then we can have what we call nervine, here's a $2,000, we can have Nervine trophorestorative. Trophorestorative. So these are plants that trophic, feed and restore a system that plant has an affinity for. A perfect example of this is the herb skullcap. So skullcap has long been associated with calming and supporting and nourishing the system, a frazzled nervous system and nervous system. We can take skullcap and it helps us to immediately kind of feel that calm and relaxation. But taken over a long period of time, skullcap will feed, nourish, and restore and bring back into balance the nervous system. And so it's very helpful for that. The trophorestoratives are the herbs that I think are important for us to the basis when we create an herbal formula. We always need to have those trophorestoratives as the base, because our ultimate goal has to always be to try to bring balance back to a system that's out of balance. Mm-hmm. And that's through nourishment, those nutrients, but through the trophorestoratives. So we have something like valerian or flower or lemon balm. These are all the calming and releasing nervines that can be seriously saving, literally life-saving for someone feeling a lot of anxiety, who's got heart palpitations and panic and just is frozen with fear and anxiety. These herbs can calm us down and relax us. They calm our nervous system. They calm our musculoskeletal system. But when we combine them with something like the formula of a passion flower, passion flower is calming and relaxing to our nervous system. Passion flower is also really good for helping to quiet when our brain is chatting. Never stops talking and never helps us calm down, because brain is always chatting at us.
Call it the monkey mind.
So we have that exactly, the monkey mind, yes. So passion flower for a monkey mind and to calm our muscles. Skullcap to calm and soothe our system and also build it up. And then we throw oat straw in there to give us those nutrients, those minerals that are deficient in our soil, particularly magnesium. Magnesium is one of the most deficient nutrients in our food supply. By USDA guidelines, it is, 40% of us are deficient in magnesium. And the primary indication of magnesium deficiency, anxiety.
Really? Because I've been saying that about magnesium in lots of different sources.
Anxiety, insomnia, heart palpitations, headaches. Gosh, you look at the magnesium deficiency symptoms and it has anxiety all over it.
And oat straw. Nettles, too.
It's the richest source of magnesium.
Oat straw is interesting.
Yeah. So if we make a formula of oat straw and skull passion flower, think of what an elegant formula that is. Right? We have that immediate calming. We have that long-term boosting, and we're providing those nutrients that we're not getting from our food supply.
That's really cool.
I love herbalism. It's really fun. It's great. And we can call this magic if we don't have the language. I have the language because I have the training in chemistry. So I can take that, and my brain doesn't do well with magic, so I really like chemistry. But other people, it's just language. It's just terminology. We can call it chemistry. We can call it herbalism. It's all the same thing. The plant doesn't matter. The plants don't matter. The plants don't care. The language that we use, the effect is exactly the same.
Reminds me of something Heinlein said about any sufficiently sophisticated technology would be indistinguishable from magic.
Yes.
And when you look at how sophisticated plant chemistry is, compared to our laboratory chemistry, it could look like magic.
Absolutely. And it is, because there's so much we don't know. We don't know the full chemistry of plants. I can talk as though I know it, but I don't know the whole thing.
And the thing that's interesting to me is we don't even know the chemistry of soil. When I talk to soil experts, the degree of sophistication they understand it seems very, very low compared to so many other sciences that we have. And so anyway, yes, I understand what you're talking about. So at least another question I had. So when I look up herbs in, like, say, the herbal PDR, which is, as a doctor, that's what I have access. So it seems like they always list a wide range of seemingly unrelated issues that the herb is used for. So can you explain that? And if there's, say, like five herbs for what a person's looking for, how do they pick the one that best fits them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. Well, let's talk about insomnia as an example for that, because it's a great thing.
It's a common effect of anxiety, too.
Exactly. It's appropriate for our discussion here. So if you go to an herb book and you open it up and you say, hey, herb book, what can I take for my insomnia? It'll give you a list of 12 different herbs. So let's pick just a few of those. It'll give you valerian and passion flower and skullcap and lemon balm and oatstra and Jamaican dogwood. No, California poppy. We'll do California poppy. So those are six different herbs that can be used for insomnia. How do you choose the one? Well, remember what I was saying. The very first way that we can categorize herbs is by their energetics. We have herbs that are heating and herbs that are cooling. Well, let's look at the heating and cooling qualities. If I have a person, if you and I both have insomnia, we're both presenting with insomnia, but I have a body, a constitution, the way that my body is built, this is not a pathology. There's nothing wrong with my body. It's just that my body always tends to run hot. I'm always overheated. I'm always going to be the person who, in the middle of winter, I'm wearing a t-shirt and shorts and I have sandals on and I'm always ripping the clothes off and I'm just always overheated. Whereas you might be someone who, in the middle of summer, you've always got your sweater with you, and your skin is always going to be more of a pale color, where mine is always going to be kind of red, and you're going to have those indications of more of a colder body. Again, not a pathology; it's just your constitution, it's how your body is built. Well, if both of us were to take valerian is a very good plant for relaxing the musculoskeletal system. But it is very heating. And so if I take valerian, I get overheated. And that overheating actually has a stimulating effect on me. And we've seen that in valerian, about 20% of people have what's called a physical response. It's an opposite. And my muscles are very relaxed, but my nervous system is hyper because I've just taken a very warming plant, which is stimulating circulation.
So you said paradoxical response, right? Because the recording skipped out a little bit there. So you said that they have a paradoxical response.
Yes.
Valerian, right? Yeah, okay.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that's about 1 in 20 people have this response.
Because the overheating outweighs the calming effect. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
That's interesting.
But in a cold person, that warming would feel great for them. That warming would allow them to relax. That would move into their body the same a warm bath would. And that would allow them to go to sleep better. So our bodies are responding to the same chemistry of the plants in very different ways. It is the relationship between the body and the plant that is herbalism. Bodies are different. The plants are similar, but they're different.
Mm.
So for me, thing is, insomnia has a lot of different factors in it, right?
Right.
You can have insomnia because you've got mind. You can have insomnia because you've got chronic pain. You can have insomnia because you've got muscle constriction. You can have insomnia because you have just nervous tension, anxiety. And the chemistry of the plants will affect some. They have affinity for different. So some plants are going to be better at relaxing them. Some plants are going to be better cooling the body down. Some plants are going to be better at quieting pain. And so it is that relationship, again, of the person to the plant that makes it more appropriate. And once you start understanding how your body is, your energetic pattern, your constitution, it's easier for you to look at that list of 12 different herbs in the PDR for insomnia and say, not that one, not that one, not that one, not that one, these two. I can try these two.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
And So a lot of our drugs come from the active ingredients in herbs. Like I said, they've been separated out and concentrated and sometimes synthesized. And so what would be the benefit of using the herb over the drug? I'm sure you get that question all the time.
Sure, yeah, and it's a great question. So in the late 1800s, the Bayer Company synthesized, they took a natural occurring compound, salicylic acid, attached an acetyl group to it, because when you attach an acetyl group to a naturally occurring compound, you've now made a synthetic compound. So it's very common to create a synthetic form of a chemical by attaching an acetyl group to it. So creating acetyl salicylic acid, right? So acetyl salicylic acid is aspirin. The Bayer Company came out with that. It's a very good compound.
Good patent.
And the word aspirin, by the way, is from the Latin, the genus name for the plant meadowsweet, which at that time was in the Spirea genus. It's now in a different genus, but at that time it was the Spirea genus. So they took Spirea and an A at the beginning for an acetyl group and put A Spirea in aspirin.
I never knew that.
But when you isolate salicylic acid from meadowsweet. So meadowsweet is commonly used as a pain reliever. It's used for mild to moderate musculoskeletal pain, headaches, general pain relief. And it's a very effective, lovely plant. You know what meadowsweet is also used for? It's used for protection of the gut when there is ulceration or irritation. It protects and heals the gut lining. And what's one of the side effects of salicylic acid? It causes damage to the gut lining. When we isolated salicylic acid from the whole plant, we created a side effect that wasn't there when we used the whole plant. And we see that over and over and over again in when we remove the compound from the complex chemistry of the plant, we isolate that and concentrate it and make it much stronger than it needs to be. And then we give it to people over and over and over again. We see side effects that we didn't see because the plant, the complex chemistry of the plant and the lower dosage of the plant, the whole food form of the plant, protected against a lot of side effects.
And balance things out, right?
Balance things out.
Yeah, interesting. So well, let's talk more specifically now about herbs for anxiety and resilience. I know you've mentioned several already, but what are adaptogens and how do they work in the body?
Yeah. So adaptogens are one of my favorite classes of plants. So we were talking about nervines. Nervines have more of a direct effect on the nervous system. Adaptogens are plants that our understanding of them is that by and large, the adaptogens tend to work on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Mm. So this is the interplay between the hypothalamus in the brain regulates hormones in the body, right? The endocrine hormones, including adrenal hormones. And those adrenal hormones are the stress hormones.
Correct.
And so there we have a bridge from that endocrine system. With the adrenal hormones, we have a bridge over to the autonomic nervous system, right? Because the adrenal hormones are drivers of the fight or flight response, the stress response. So with adaptogens, being able to regulate and normalize that HPAA, the interplay between the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the adrenals, that discussion that the brain is having with the rest of the body, and regulating and normalizing the levels of those hormones, we are regulating and normalizing stress response. This kind of goes back also to what you were talking about. You were asking, you know, how can a single plant have so many diverse effects in the body, right? Seemingly unconnected effects in the body.
Physiologically, yeah. Because in medicine, that's always a warning sign of something that's quackery, you know? That's something that's useful for too many things is always looked at suspiciously in medicine.
But if you have a reductionist view of the body and you think, well, pancreas is the pancreas and the thyroid is the thyroid and the adrenals are the adrenals and the gonads are the gonads and they're all separate. Well, But a holistic view says, nah, those are all part of the one body, and they're all part of that endocrine system. And they all feed back to that hypothalamic pituitary discussion. And so we can have an adaptogen that regulates that response. And by regulating that response, what we see is regulation of blood sugar levels, because the pancreas is an endocrine gland, and secretion of insulin is part of that axis. We see regulation of thyroid hormone. We see regulation of estrogen and progesterone and testosterone. We see regulation of cortisol. We can see seemingly disparate systems all coming online and all being affected by the same plant, because it's one body and everything talks to the rest. This reductionist mindset, this reductionist point of view of the body does not help us. And it is not the way the body works.
It's gotten us into a lot of trouble. Yeah.
It has got us into so much trouble. Absolutely. And so adaptogens allow our body to adapt to stressors in our environment that we perceive as stress, those things that narrow our resilience, those things that, and we all have this feeling at some point or another, we all have this feeling of, if one more thing comes on my plate, if one more thing around me changes, I am going to lose it.
I'm going to explode.
Yes. I have no resilience. My level of resilience is directly outside my skin. Well, adaptogens increase that range of resilience. And they do that by regulating that hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, by helping to reduce the stress response, stopping our body going into full-blown sympathetic dominant state when someone cuts us off on the freeway, or they're out of the vanilla syrup at the Starbucks that we go to, or whatever is the straw that breaks the camel's back, that taking those adaptogens give us that grace. It gives us that extra resilience so that we can say, you know what? I don't need to have a full-blown physiological response to this thing. I can have this change in my environment and still have that grace and calm.
Yeah, that's really cool. So it's pretty clear that adaptogens do have these powerful effects. So can you explain some of the uses and then misuses of adaptogens so that people can get the most benefit from them?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of marketing of adaptogens right now. They're this new sexy thing. If you go into any Whole Foods or anywhere, you're going to see lots of adaptogens being sold. And quite often it is, if you read the label, there's a lot of different plants that are classified as adaptogens. But so often products, they just grab a bunch of adaptogens and throw them into a jar and call them an adaptogen blend. But in just the same way as we were talking about the herbs for insomnia, right? And the energetic changes and the appropriateness for different bodies, that's true for adaptogens as well. There are adaptogens that are very strongly stimulating, and there are very adaptogens that are calming. There are adaptogens that are warming and cooling, and all of that complex chemistry of plants makes each adaptogen unique, and they can have secondary and tertiary effects that are going to make them more appropriate for different people. So really understanding the full story of the adaptogen is going to help us. For example, I'll just get two of them. Ashwagandha is an adaptogen from Ayurvedic tradition, and it is a warming adaptogen. It is, its botanical name is Withania somniferum. Somniferum speaks of sleep. And so it is warming, but also helps us to sleep better. But when we wake up in the morning, because we've slept better, it can increase our vitality and increase our health. So people use it for chronic but debilitating weakness and anxiety and fatigue and just loss of vitality, generally after a long-term chronic illness or just being beaten down by our culture and our society and our lives, where we need something that is going to nourish and support us and build us up. Ashwagandha is lovely for that. There's another one called rhodiola. And rhodiola is very energizing and it's stimulating. And it is the worst thing for those people who have that weakness because they're overworked, they're overtired, they're just depleted. Well, the last thing that that depleted, overtired body needs is a stimulant like rhodiola that is going to give them effectively, like caffeine, it's going to give them an artificial boost of energy and allow them to go out and work out more or take on another shift at work. Or
so it's like whipping a tired horse then.
Exactly. And that is, I think, one of the dangers of adaptogens, because in our culture, we center and we value the Protestant work ethic, which says work, 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 and make your way in this world and work, work, work. And really what we need so often is we need sleep. We need restoration. We need to go home and put on our jammies and make ourselves some tea and go to bed early and stay in bed and take some time off from work and go to the beach and be in the garden. We need that calm restoration. And we don't get it because our culture does not value that. Our culture says that that is being lazy. And so we can use adaptogens to artificially boost up our energy levels and they will work. But what we are doing is we are digging that hole deeper and deeper and deeper. Right. And we're using herbs, we're using adaptogens in the name of healing, but that is not healing.
Right. Because what eventually happens to that tired horse if you whip them enough, right?
Yeah. And that's what happens to us.
That's really interesting because almost every combination adaptogen patients bring in for me to look at will have ashwagandha and rhodiola combined in the same formula. It's very rare to see them not in the same formula.
And you know, one of the things is if I always make my students taste rhodiola by itself. If you take rhodiola in a tablet or a capsule, you're just swallowing it. You have no idea the energetics of that plant. But if you take rhodiola in a liquid, in a tincture, which is an alcohol and water extract, and you put that on your tongue. Rhodiola is one of the most astringent plants. It's drying. Think of the most oaky wine that you've ever, if you drink wine, an oaky wine, you drink it and your mouth just puckers up. It just goes.
All the tannins.
Dries up all those tannins, just bind to the proteins and dry it up. Very, very drying to the body, right? So, well, consider for a person who has a lot of dryness in their body. They are dehydrated. They don't drink enough water. The fluids that they drink are coffee and Diet Coke, and they don't like water. And so they're drinking all of that, and they're taking rhodiola. Rhodiola is extraordinarily drying, and it's extraordinarily astringent. And in a person with a constitution that is very, very dry and very tense, you put rhodiola in that body, and you're increasing that dryness and tension. That is not going to be an adaptogenic formula that is going to give calm and relaxation. That body needs moisture, and it needs relaxation. And you do not get moisture and relaxation from rhodiola. And if you're taking it as a capsule, you will never know that.
That's pretty sobering.
So I love it. Rhodiola is great. But rhodiola for those people who are really damp, who are holding on to all that water, and they're really, really lax. They're just, you know, they're edematous, and they've got diarrhea, and they have urinary incontinence, you know, all of this leakiness of tissues and holding on of fluids. They take that rhodiola and they get that tone and they get that dryness. That's going to feel wonderful for their bodies. It's not that rhodiola is bad.
Right.
It's that rhodiola for certain bodies is inappropriate.
Right. So it just seems like the body that's good for rhodiola might not be good for ashwagandha and vice versa. And the fact that they're always together in the same formulas means that it's not going to work for, not going to be ideal for anybody, right?
Right.
So I see what you're saying. So in medicine, we have drugs for anxiety that actually are quite effective. You know, they literally drop this curtain between the person and their anxiety. But most of those drugs are also very addictive and then have a lot of other side effects. So So how effective are the herbs for anxiety, and are they safe, you know, any safer than the drugs?
So when we talk about addiction, there are many ways that addiction presents. Mm-hmm. And we can become addicted to an herb because of the way it makes us feel, even though all the literature, all the traditions say, no, absolutely, there are no addictive qualities to this. Addiction is a complex situation.
Exactly.
And if someone is taking California poppy, so it is in the Papaveraceae family, this is the poppy family, it is distantly related to opium poppies. Right? And it contains papaverine alkaloids. The chemicals in California poppy are escholosine and californidine. These are the two primary alkaloids that are found in there that give it a lot of the calming, relaxing effects. It is absolutely in a relaxant. It is very effective. They are not addictive. There have been exhaustive studies on the use of the papaverine alkaloids in California poppy, and they are found to be non-addictive. However, I have seen people who take California poppy for insomnia and for anxiety, and when they don't take it, they don't feel as good. And so they have, you know, it's created a somewhat of an addiction because they want to take California poppy every day because it helps them to feel more balanced.
Well, and that's one of my definitions of addiction is feeling management. So you're just trying to manage your feelings. So if they're taking it just for symptomatic control, yeah, of course they can be addicted to it.
If we go back to that formula that we were talking about earlier with the nervines, we rarely use single herbs by themselves.
Right.
Had someone come in to see me who had anxiety or insomnia, I would not give them just California poppy and have them walk out the door. I would give them California poppy and say, you know what? Why don't you take Skullcap with this? And why don't you take magnesium as a supplement? And let's take an adaptogen. Let's take some ashwagandha along with this. And let's create a protocol, because the goal, the end goal, is let's not take California poppy, because California poppy is not healing our anxiety and it's not healing our insomnia. It is wonderful for symptomatic relief, but that's not our goal. Symptomatic relief is not my goal. My goal is healing. So if I create a protocol around that, if I create an herbal formula that gives that them that nourishment and support and balancing of the system at the same time that the California poppy is giving them that symptomatic relief, when we start to step down the California poppy, they're going to feel okay. And we're going to be able to move to a point where maybe we're still taking the skull and the magnesium and the ashwagandha, but we're not taking the California poppy anymore. And then we will drop down the ashwagandha. We're not taking the ashwagandha anymore. We drop down the skull cap. We've put into place all sorts of other things to increase their resilience and to nourish their system. And they're not taking it. And I think that that is one of the big differences between the use of medications. And I am not opposed to appropriate medication in treatment of anything. We will use any tools at our disposal that help people to feel their best. But we don't see protocols like that in the medical field. And I would Right. love to see the medical field work with herbalism and nutrition to create protocols like around the use of insomnia meds, That would be great, a meeting of those worlds that would best support our clients and our patients. And also, you know, give the best of medications and give the best of herbs and nutrition.
Now, that's actually a really great idea, because, I mean, my main issue with the tools of conventional medicine, I mean, the tools are great. They usually work really well. It's just the consciousness with which they're applied. That's my major issue. And to use them just purely symptomatically with no effort to find root causes or treat imbalances, and you know, it just doesn't work very well. And so here at the Seven Tools, we teach that feelings are messengers, bringing us information about what's going on around us and within us, and how we're interpreting all of that. So, but in my office, I find that people taking anti-anxiety drugs often don't have access to those anxious feelings, and so they end up going unprocessed. And then when it comes time for the person to stop the drug, they often have these rebound anxieties and even frank panic attacks where they didn't get panic attacks before they started the drug. So, and it can take up to a year with lots of therapy and other support to actually get somebody weaned off of their anxiety medication. And so do you see the same kind of issues when someone uses herbs to treat their anxiety? That the feelings go unprocessed and they kind of back up in the wings, so to speak?
No, because herbs are not anywhere near as strong as many of the medications, which is one of the weaknesses of herbs, right? Sometimes the herbs don't work. Sometimes the herb isn't strong enough and you need those medications for certain people. It's not because they are, it's nothing wrong with the plants. It's nothing wrong with the person. There's just biochemistry in the brain is wonky for whatever reason they need those
herbs. Or maybe they've put off addressing until it gets so bad. You know, don't listen to the subtler symptoms and wait for the 2x4 upside the head, you know, before they get treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I tend not to see, again, the way that I use herbs and the way that I formulate, I think stops that from happening. And I could definitely see that with some of the very strong herbs used by themselves would possibly have those potentials, that potential for concern. I generally don't see that though.
That's great. No, that's really great. So what are some of the specific herbs that you often use for anxiety? And I know you've been mentioning several of them through the talk, and I really like the way that you will make a specific formula for each person based on their general constitution and other symptoms going on. So I know it's hard to single out specific herbs, but just so that listeners can maybe get familiar with the names a little bit. You mentioned ashwagandha, rhodiola, skullcap, valerian.
Yeah. Some of my favorite herbs specifically for anxiety, motherwort. Motherwort is, I love this plant so much.
Your video on motherwort this morning.
Oh, was it motherwort or was it mugwort?
Oh, you're right. You're right. It was mugwort. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Everyone always confuses those two. Yep.
A wort looks like a wort. No.
It is a wort. Wort is an old English term for a plant. So you see St. John's wort and mugwort and motherwort and bladderwort. Motherwort is, the Latin name for motherwort, Leonuris cardiaca, which translates to lion-hearted.
Oh, yeah.
And motherwort is the plant for giving us courage, for giving us that lion heart. It is, it's also a plant that has that mother energy to it. I really love motherwort for when we are feeling like we just can't with the world, that it's just too much, that we feel that overwhelm and that fear that comes from having to move out in the world. Motherwort has the energy. This is one, by the way, I cannot explain with the chemistry, but I have seen it over and over and over again. So this is a magic one.
Okay.
Motherwort has that energy, that positive mother energy. And I say this with the acknowledgement that mother energy does not always feel positive or safe for many people.
But archetypal mother.
Yeah. So you can think of it as Leonuris. If the name mother does not feel safe for you, we can use other language. But for Leonuris, it is that hug, that warmth, and that hug that of a mother or a parental figure embracing their child and saying, "I love you and I support you, and you can do anything, and I have got your back. And you go out there and do it, and I will be here for you, cheering you on." That is the energy of motherwort. So it gives us that strength and that bravery. I love motherwort for anxiety. Now, one of the things that I do want to say about motherwort is it's also very good at helping us kind of move through when we've created barriers around us, helping us to kind of break down those barriers, break down those walls, and move beyond those. And that can be really lovely for people, and that can also be inappropriate, because quite often, you know this very well, there are reasons that we create those boundaries and those barriers. There's reasons that we've created those protections around us. And sometimes, if we are not ready to have those barriers removed, mm-hmm. and a plant comes in and removes those for us, that can feel really unsafe. And so for people who have a lot of those barriers and those boundaries, sometimes we need to move forward with motherwort and drop dosages, very small amounts of slowly introducing this plant and allowing the person to move forward at the rate that they are comfortable with in lowering slowly down those. I've seen people move too strongly with motherwort and create problems. But when they go back and start in with just drop dose, just small amounts and move forward, it's miraculous.
So you're talking about like the kind of barriers someone might put up who's had a broken heart, or the kind of barriers that someone might put up if they've been abused as a child, or those kinds of barriers?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Those that have saved our lives. That's why we put them up, because we needed those to survive. They served us well. And
but if somebody feels trapped behind their barriers and they want to move through them, they've been trying to in therapy for years and can't get through them, then this might actually be helpful for them, because they've got the support of the therapy.
Exactly. It's awesome for that. It's just that they need to be aware that that's going to be happening. They need to be ready to do that work. And if they are aware and ready, motherwort is transformative.
Amazing. Okay. That's really most of my patients. That's great to know.
Yeah, it's so many of us. Another one is lemon balm. And I love lemon balm because you don't have to be so careful with it. It's lemon balm. It's delightful. It's beautiful. It's joyous. It's happy. The aroma of lemon balm is uplifting and mood elevating. It is calming and relaxing. It's safe. It's good for children. It's good for, you know, there's no contraindications with medications. By the way, just to say, you may sometimes hear that lemon balm is contraindicated for people with hypothyroid disorders, that it will lower thyroid levels. And that is not correct information. I know three herb schools with clinics, and they've specifically been looking at that. They see no change in thyroxine levels or thyroid activity when they use lemon balm. So
it's good to know, because so many people have thyroid issues. That's important. Yeah.
Exactly. And it stops a lot of people from taking lemon balm who would be well served by lemon balm. Mm. So that has been exhaustively looked at and has been debunked. It is not, it's absolutely safe.
But isn't it amazing how much harder it is to get the debunking information out there than it was to get the false information out there?
You know? Yeah. Well, the reason why it was considered to be helpful for that is because it's really good for hyperthyroidism. Lemon balm has that calming, soothing, relaxing effect that makes it really lovely as an ally for hyperthyroid people. It helps to regulate heart rate and it helps to calm down that jitteriness. It's perfect. But the extrapolation from that was, well, therefore, it has an effect on thyroid levels. It has no effect on thyroid levels. It's not working on the thyroid. It's just working on calming and relaxing the physiology. And so it's beneficial for hyperthyroidism, and it is not problematic for hypothyroidism.
Thank you. That makes good sense.
Yeah. And it's lovely, and it's safe, and it's wonderful. And then one more plant that I love for anxiety is rose.
Rose?
Rose. Yeah. And this one also is sort of a little bit sort of the magical stuff, but rose. So rose is beautiful. Rose is gorgeous. It is lovely to give someone medicine containing rose because it's delightful, and delight is healing. Delight is profoundly healing. But beyond that, rose is an herb that we can use to kind of open up a heart that has been closed. Again, that barrier, that boundary of closing the heart can be protective and can have saved lives. There's good reasons why we close our hearts down. Served us at that time, they don't serve us now, and we want to kind of move through and open up that heart energy. Rose is really awesome for that. And we can use rose as an indicator of what we call thorn medicine. So rose, think of a rose plant. Rose is beautiful. It's lush. It's gorgeous. It's sexy. It is aromatic. It is beautiful. And it also has lots of thorns there. So the message of thorn medicine, especially with rose, and especially with women who are not allowed to own their sensuality and their sexuality and feel like, I can't be this beautiful, open self without having people breach my barriers, without having people insert themselves into my space, right, and into my body.
Unasked,
right,
for.
I give up agency over my body if I allow my beauty to be there. But rose tells us differently. Rose says you can have both beauty, complete sensual beauty as much as you want, and also you have appropriate boundaries that you get to control. You have agency over your boundaries.
Thorns.
That is a really important lesson for people to learn.
That is amazing, yeah.
Yeah. I love rose medicine.
That is so amazing. I really appreciate all that. That's really good, specific information. So how could we use herbs to increase our range of resilience to what's going on, rather than just treating anxiety once it's there? So increasing resilience in the first place.
So a broad protocol for resilience, without creating a specific, because it would depend on the person, of course.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. But use of an appropriate adaptogen, because regulating that hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis automatically increases resilience. That's why we do it. It helps to...
That's by definition, just about.
Yeah, exactly. But along with that, because we don't use just a single herb and consider that we have fixed it, using those restorative herbs for the nervous system. So skullcap is one. Another one is milky oats, is moistening and cooling and nourishing and rebuilding to a frazzled, overworked, stressed out body. We can throw milky oats or skullcap or damiana, one of the plants that is healing and restoring specifically the nervous system. So adaptogens have the term adaptogen. Specifically includes a non-specific effect, that it is regulating and increasing that resilience, but not to a specific system, right? Resilience of the whole body.
Yeah.
But plants are very complex chemically, and so it's going to have that non-specific resilience effect, and it can also have a specific secondary or tertiary effect, right? Okay. So we can use an adaptogen for that response. We can throw in a nervous system trophorestorative that specifically nourishes the nervous system. We can give those other nutrients that the body needs for rebuilding and restoring the nervous system health. And that would include things like B vitamins and magnesium and omega-3 fatty acids, DHA, methylation compounds. There's a lot of nutrients that we didn't even discuss nutrition, but there's a lot of nutrients that are also really important for helping to give our body that foundation that will allow it to heal itself. And that gives us that resilience. Nourishing those systems, bringing them back into balance, will automatically also increase that resilience. And one more thing about resilience. Ooh, and I love this.
Okay.
We have actions that we take every day that decrease our resilience that we have centered and normalized. And those are things like wearing our shoes when we go outside. If we wear shoes every time we go outside, then if we go outside with our shoes off, all of a sudden we are unsafe. The ground is too pokey. It's uncomfortable. Oh, we have decreased our resilience by wearing shoes all the time. We decrease our resilience by having heaters and air conditioning, by wearing sunglasses, by having clothes. All of the things that modify our environment for our comfort decrease our resilience.
Interesting idea.
Because now if we get a little bit cold or a little bit hot, we're outside of our range of comfort.
We don't know what to do with it anymore, yeah.
Right. We go outside without our sunglasses. Oh, the sun is too bright. Oh, no, I can't function without my sunglasses. So all of the ways in which we can look at how we have changed our environment to decrease our resilience and changing those. Take off your shoes sometimes when you go outside. Be a little bit cold and a little bit hot and be okay with that. Don't turn on the air conditioner all the time. You know, if you can, sometimes there are people who really need that for their safety and their health, and that's okay. There's lots of different ways that we can increase that resilience in our environment. Just looking to, how can I do this? Seemingly small things can have profound effects because they teach our body that it is stronger than we give it credit for. It can take cold and it can take heat and it can take being outside without our sunglasses or without our shoes on. And every time we learn those lessons about our physical body, that gives us more resilience.
That is a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
I haven't heard any other speakers talk about that. That's great.
I know. I was pretty excited when I thought about it. I was just talking about it with some of my students and thought, oh, wait a second. It was one of those things. Yeah.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
love it. And it's true, right? Because you can tell it's true. You hear it and you go, yes.
Yeah.
We should all be talking about that.
Yeah. Well, I'll think about that. That's really cool. So one other question I really want to ask you, but I know we're out of time, but I'm sure I'd love to talk with you a couple more hours. That'd be great. But so it sounds like when you treat someone for anxiety, you don't just use herbs, but you also talk to them about their diet and nutrition. So how do you weave these things together? So in general, do you approach treating someone with How do you approach treating someone with stress and anxiety? Now, you've answered some of that a little bit already. I just wanted to make sure you had a chance to say everything you wanted to say on that topic.
We are complex beings, and the reasons for anxiety are so complex, so often more than we know. So when we create a protocol, I use herbs, and I use a lot of herbs, and then I'll use nutrients appropriate to the person. Sometimes they don't want to take pills. That's fine. We can modify diet. There's a lot of ways that we can modify the diet to get those nutrients in. Sometimes we have to use the supplements, but maybe for a short period of time, and then we're bumping up the diet so that we can go off of the supplement. But along with that, I'm also doing, you know, I want them to do whatever type of spiritual work calls them. Right? If it's prayer or meditation or gardening or taking care of animals, whatever feeds their soul and gives their life meaning and purpose and an understanding of their place in the world.
Yeah.
That is as critical as the herbs. That is every bit as critical as the herbs, and that has to be part of the protocol. And I want to look at their sleep. Sleep is so important. They need sleep. And sometimes before I even get to work with the herbs for anxiety, I'm gonna work on getting them a good night's sleep. And so maybe I won't even start to talk about the adaptogens until they can give me a good, at least 6 hours of sleep per night. Because I don't want them using the adaptogens to feel better. I want them to sleep.
To feel better. Yeah, I think about sleep. Sleep is right up there with air and water as far as how important it is. So that's kind of where I put it. And if you're not, if you're tired, but you're not sleeping well, you can do a million other things to try to feel better, and they're not, it's not going to work. So that's really wise, and I appreciate it. And then you have verbal protocols or verbal approaches to help with sleep too, right?
So one of my teachers, he always said, aspire to be a boring herbalist. And by that he meant make people drink water, make people sleep well, give them nutrition. Do all of that and then go on to the sexy herbs, you know, but nutrition and sleep and hydration, you know, and meaning in life, all of that, it's all part of it.
Now that is wonderful. Now, I really appreciate your approach, and it's clear that you've put in so many hours of study over your career and observing people and seeing what works and what doesn't work, and coming up with a better and better approach to helping people, including, like, a lot of people forget about, well, it's important to do what's meaningful to you. You know, a lot of people forget about putting that into their prescription. So I really appreciate you doing that. That's so amazing. So if you could leave our listeners with just three tidbits of advice about herbs and anxiety, what would they be?
So my three tidbits would be, seek to nourish and balance the system before going to the stronger herbs. You know, this is sort of what we've been saying all along, but really I can't emphasize that enough. Bringing balance back to the system is going to help us to not have that dependency on the herbs in the first place.
Right.
So if we use those nourishing herbs first and form the basis with those nourishing herbs and form a basis of those herbs that bring that restoration and balance, those are the herbs that we primarily want to work with. So that would be one. The other is, you know, don't go for the strongest herbs first. And it's understandable. Someone who's dealing with so much pain in their life, they're going to want to grab the strongest sedating herb around, the strongest medicine around, but that doesn't always serve us well. And so we can always take something stronger. We can move our way up in dosing or in using a different plant, but we can't come down from that. Even if it works, sometimes what they perceive as working has been suppression of symptoms, and they're kind of stuck on that, no, this has suppressed my symptoms and I want to stay with it. And it can make it a little bit more of a challenge to then kind of come back from that and say, well, okay.
Let's now get to the root.
Let's now get to the root, exactly.
Yeah.
And we can, and if someone really needs that, then I will say, fine, use the valerian and the California poppy, use those really strong ones, and I'm also going to give you all of this other stuff. And so I would say that's also maybe one of the third tidbits is use of herbs for anxiety should always be with the goal of not taking them. The long-term goal is I'm not going to be taking this lemon balm or St. John's wort or whatever, because if we're just giving the person the herbs and saying, there you go for the rest of your life, you're going to be drinking lemon balm tea, we have not actually created healing there. So we always want to have the long-term goal is we're going to get to a point where you don't need this. There's never anyone with a lemon balm deficiency. That's not a thing.
But right? What about a Prozac deficiency?
Also not a thing. Right. And if doctors had always given Prozac with the understanding, this is what you need right now, and let's have the long-term goal that we're going to get you off of this. That's wonderful.
That's wonderful. Great. But that's heresy, because that doesn't fit the drug company business plan. No, anyway.
I know.
But thank you so much. I really appreciate your insights and your wisdom. And so you have, what if people want to learn more about herbs, or you have a store, you have classes, that sort of thing. You want to talk about those for just a second?
Yeah, sure. I'm based in Southern California in Long Beach, and I do quite a lot of teaching. Teaching is what I love, so I do a lot of classes.
I bet you're really good at it.
I am. You know, it's really lovely to find a thing that you're really good at, and I learned to stop being humble at it. I'm good at teaching. I do well at giving information about things, but I love it. It's really fun. So I have a store. So I have a little an herb store that is also the school that I run my classes out of, and I do a lot of things online because I have a lot of people who are not in Southern California who would like to learn with me and can't. So on my Facebook page, Green Wisdom Herbal Studies Facebook page, I run quite a lot of Facebook Live videos. So they're free. I just do them as a service to the community. So you can go on our website and see archived videos, hundreds of hours of archived videos on specific herbs, on medicine making, and various aspects of herbalism. And then I do have a 1 to 2 year apprenticeship program where I take on students who are with me for a full year in here, and in we have an apothecary garden that I growing herbs in medicine making, and we go over anatomy and physiology and pathology and chemistry and all of that. We get to go deeper in.
Nice. Great. Well, that was it. So what was your Facebook page again?
Green Wisdom Herbal Studies.
Green Wisdom Herbal Studies. Okay. I think we could probably put that in something printed with the summit too. So, because that sounds like an amazing resource. All those hours of videos. That'd be an amazing resource.
Yeah.
So anything else? I really, really appreciate it. I can't thank you enough for sharing your wisdom with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm honored to be here with you.
All right.
And thank you for doing this work. This is, I mean, you know, this is so necessary. We need to be talking about resilience. We need to be helping people to find that in themselves.
Yeah, I was just looking at some more updated statistics this morning, and it's now well over 50% of Americans classify themselves as stressed out. And, you know, up to 90% have experienced some kind of stress experience within the last month. I mean, this is well beyond epidemic. And what we're doing obviously isn't working because the numbers keep going up every year. So we need this new revolutionary way to help ourselves and deal with stress. So I really appreciate you being a part of that and you know, helping us to get this word out. That's going to be great.
Thank you.